session number 20895, reel 9.
John Deere reel 9.
Our reluctance to shoot the wolves, not so much humanitarian, but we didn't want to alert the enemy. However, all went well, and it came to the time of the crossing itself, much the same pattern on a lower scale as the Rhine crossing. Our objective was the town of Lauenburg, and we were to make a bridgehead on the Elbe further downstream of Lauenburg and take the town from that direction. The artillery supporting fire was not on the scale of the Rhine crossing, but nevertheless was pretty heavy, and the crossing was relatively straightforward. Six Commando took the bridgehead, and then I think 46 Commando were to lead into Lauenburg, followed by 45 Commando. B Troop led 45, and our task, the troops' task, was to capture an Ack-Ack battery situated on the heights of Lauenburg, overlooking the river and the bridge, which had already been destroyed. There were no particular problems over this. The crossing went well as far as we were concerned. We moved into Lauenburg, passed through 46 Commando, and started to turn to the right, as it were, heading for the troop objective. There was a very narrow road with houses either side of it leading to the Ack-Ack battery, and I was reluctant to have the whole troop in that narrow road, and paused just meditating on my move here, when someone very close behind me fired a rifle. I had always warned the troop against unnecessary rifle firing, and I turned around ready to rend the culprit, and found it was my own orderly, Jock Irvin. My harsh words of abuse had to be adjusted, and Irvin said he had seen movement in a window and had fired at it. I'll break in here to say that after the operation, I got one of the 10 Commando people to go and find out what happened there, and found that Irvin had in fact wounded a German civilian who unwisely had moved to look out of his window when he heard footsteps in the ground below. Anyway, on with the war. I decided to send one group, Graham Partington and his section, down the backs of one lot of houses, with the remainder of us moving down the main little road. And at this point, Nicol Gray came up to me and very quietly pointed out, soon getting daybreak, and I'd better get a move on. So on we went. I patted Graham on the back to show him the way to go. He took two paces forward and went straight down into what I believe was a lavatory pit. Leaving him to deal with that, I then moved down with the rest of the troop, and then was joined up very shortly by Graham and his section at the battery itself, which we took without any problems. We had, unfortunately, to kill a number of Germans there because they refused to come out of their dugouts, and we had to dispose of them with grenades. But that was unfortunate. We did take about 50 prisoners there. Lauenburg was a very short stop. I think we may have stayed a day there. The German Luftwaffe once again made an appearance, and our forward observation officer from the mountain regiment fired at them, and is certain he shot down a Focke Wulf 190 with one of the light Ack-Ack guns we'd captured. Whether this was correct or not, I don't know, but I know they certainly did fire at the Luftwaffe using the German guns. We then set forth towards the Baltic, which was our ultimate objective. We were heading now around about the 1st of May, I think this was, through a village called Wangelau, I can't remember quite how one pronounced it, where we had our final battle, which involved B Troop, but A and E Troops, and one of my old sergeants from E Troop, Jock Wilson, was killed there. On our way, I think still, yes, we must have been moving on foot still, we came across a group of RAF officers who had been liberated from a nearby prisoner of war camp. And I remember asking them if any of their guards had behaved badly towards them, whether I had in mind at the time that if that was so, we would take some retaliatory action. I'm not quite sure. But the RAF officer said no, they had no particularly no bad feelings towards any of their guards, and so we left them and moved on. We arrived at Neustadt on, I think, the 2nd of May, and there was great scenes here, though it's hard to differentiate between what I saw myself and what I heard from my brother officers and men who got around other parts of the town, but there were talk of civilian bodies being found in the harbour. These, I understood, had been concentration camp victims. Certainly at Neustadt, there was a concentration camp on a very small scale. And I remember going through this and seeing the conditions of the few people who remained there, and the close, concentrated living conditions. But I'm trying to think of this now as I thought of it in May 45. The horror of the whole thing didn't really strike me. There were these unfortunate individuals. We were then, although we had passed Belsen earlier in the campaign, I remember Belsen. We never actually saw the camp, but I remember the smell. We'd spent the night in bivouacs, I suppose perhaps a mile from the camp, and even at that distance, the smell was noticeable. But here at Neustadt, as I say, I wasn't really conscious of what it was all about, but there were these few wretched, unfortunate people. And then, I think probably on 8th of May itself, we then moved on to our concentration, not concentration area, our administrative area. The commander was based at a place called Malente, rather at Eutin, E-U-T-I-N, and I, with B and with C Troop under command, became town commandant of Malente, which was a smaller town about 5 miles away. A lovely situation with two lakes which we use for recreational purposes. Very much a hospital area, masses of hotels and so on, buildings taken over as hospitals, and masses of German moving around, but no incidents of any kind. At Malente, I took the surrender of the German admiral, a surgeon, rear, or I think vice admiral, who at his headquarters surrendered to me and handed me his pistol. At the same time, or it might have been a day later, he asked if he could hold on to the concert party that was entertaining the German wounded, and I very seriously considered this and agreed equally seriously on condition that his concert party should also perform for the two troops that I had there, and this they did. Hilarious occasion. Unfortunately, all the party, all the concert party were men, but it was hilarious.
Were they Germans?
Oh, yes, they were German. But they tried very hard to cope with the language barrier. And I suppose we were willing, really, to laugh at anything. It was, I don't know, an hour and a half of laughter the whole time. Our activities here in Malindi were really few and far between. We were involved in searching for Himmler, which meant that we raided various houses out in the country. There was no hard information to go on. And I remember, in many ways, I'm embarrassed to talk about it now, but you want sort of factual information. We went to look at one farm building, very well set up. There was no war damage here. There was really no sign of the war, except the mass of wounded around and so on. And this was an established farm and looked prosperous, run by, I remember describing it at the time as a hard-faced old bitch, which is probably very unkind. I suppose she was, bearing in mind I was 23, I suppose she was perhaps in her 50s. And I would guess a very conscientious and good farmer. But we searched for him, no sign of him there. But I was horrified at the condition of, I think there were Poles who were working on the farm, living in what normally would be the cow sheds and so on. Whereas in the house itself, it was clearly very prosperous. And she had a few German farmhands as well. Anyway, I had with me one of the ubiquitous Ten Commander German speakers. And I said to him, tell this, as I say, I use the expression, tell this hard-faced old bitch that she and her family are to move out of the house, and the Poles are to come in, and the Germans can live out where the Poles are living. And he started to interpret, and she interrupted and said to him, looking at me, there is no need for you to interpret. I have understood what the captain said. At that stage, I must have gone very red, and I departed, leaving the Lance Corporal from Ten Commander to carry out my instructions, which he did with ill-concealed glee. What else was there? A couple of other interesting things there, which apart from looking for Himmler, we had the German army now was of course disbanding, there was a large area of concentration to the north of us, in a wooded area. I mean, I never went into it, but I know I did drive up once to the boundary where the German field gendarmerie were stationed. And there were large number of German troops marching through, disarmed, of course, but through Malente to this area. We were supposed to stop them singing, but they sang, and to stop them singing was, anyway, they sang and we didn't bother, we didn't interfere. They sang very well, usually. But it was interesting because on one occasion, I was told this afterwards by one of the sergeants who was on duty in the town that day, that a German officer had broken free from the marching Germans, and in speaking in fair English, said to this sergeant, I see you have a green beret. Were you fighting in the, I think he called it the 18, no, not 18, in the Linney area? And when the sergeant said, yes, he was, this German officer said he would very much like to speak to an officer because he had fought against the commanders there and he would very much like to discuss the battle. Well, unfortunately, the German field police hauled this chap back into the line before the message got to me. Otherwise, I would have enjoyed discussing the battle with him. And other, again, as a token of the future, Jock Irvin, my MOA, had a discussion with a German officer who said that undoubtedly before too long, he and I, he the British, as it were, and I, the Germans, would be allied against the Russians. After about a fortnight, I think, in Valente, I developed a throat infection, sent back to hospital somewhere, in Lüneburg, in fact, of all places. And by the time I came out, the whole brigade had returned back to England, and I flew home to join them. And that's the end of my war.
Why did you not decide to stay on in the Marines?
Oh, I did. I stayed on until 1951. I was, as I think I said at the beginning, a regular. Do you want anything? 2 minutes on that?
Yes, please.
When the commander returned to Germany, after leave, I joined up with them again, Blitz at Bexhill. They were still, and this is still pre-atom bomb. This is about, early July, I would guess, mid-July. The word went, well, it wasn't a question, the word gave around, the CEO, Nicol Gray, who was leaving the unit, before he left the unit, at a final parade, told them that the unit, less those who were being demobbed, because that was starting now, would be going to the Far East. And he was leaving, and Alf Blake was leaving, and a number of men were leaving because they came up to the demob point. And I decided that I also wanted to leave, that I felt that the unit would no longer, there were so many of my old friends leaving, no longer be the sort of, you know, the home it had been. And also, my brother, who had been working in Malaya, had been taken prisoner by the Japanese. And I had some vague thought of getting into one of the, organizations that were parachuting into Malaya. And I thought that if I got away from a formed unit, I would be more likely to be taken on into one of these funnies. I don't know. I don't think at that stage I don't think it was Force 385 or I don't know, I can't remember the names of them now. And at that time I don't think I knew them, but I knew there were organizations that were doing this sort of thing. And that was at the back of my mind as well. Anyway, that was that. I left the unit. I was then told I was posted to something called the Holding Operational Commando, brackets light, as distinct from the one at Wrexham, which was going to be set up in India and would be used as a reinforcement depot. So that suited me. I thought, you know, I'm getting in the right area and I can find out more there. I knew that my old CO, Peter Wellman Lushington, was now on Mountbatten's staff, as I think assistant chief of staff, so I thought, well, I may have an opening there to get where I want to. Anyway, that was what I had in mind. I went on leave, having been told that when I came back from leave, I'd be flying out to India. And it was returning from leave, and I remember it well, except I can't think of the name. I had to return to Portsmouth because the unit was somewhere in this area, Chichester way somewhere. And is it Temple Coombe? Is there a station called Temple Coombe Junction?
Yes, there's a railway station there.
That's it. Temple Coombe, just before I left, a couple of days earlier, news of the first atom bomb, but you know, it was in the paper, didn't know what it meant. And I came back on leave, and one had to, from Exeter to Portsmouth, you had to, in those days, change at Temple Coombe Junction. And when I arrived there, the whole station, such as it was, half a dozen grizzly old men and a few women, I suppose, stations are, were more or less dancing with glee. The Japanese surrender had just been announced, so this would have been, what, the 15th of August, is it, something like that? So that was that. Clearly I wasn't going to go to India. But I then, being a lucky chap, Wildman Ushington had returned to England, I didn't know this at the time, and was now the GOC commander group. His G1 was Tim Gray, and Peter Lushington had been my CO in the 1st Battalion. Tim Gray had been the adjutant that I had relieved in the 1st Battalion. So I was able there to get a staff job at Commander Group Headquarters. And then that was mostly, of course, concerned with the running down of the commando organisation. I then moved up to Wales, to what was then known as the Royal Marines Training Group Wales, where the commander, the brigade commander, was General Lester, who had also been my CO in the 1st Battalion, so I was doing well with having friends in the right places. And one of the things we were asked for then, and I remember it coming from COHQ, was they were looking for volunteers to serve with the British military mission to France, acting to help the French to set up a commando school. So this was passed around units in North Wales, there were three or four, and I think we had about half a dozen names on the volunteers, and I looked at them. So I put my own name on the top of the list, went into General Lester with it, and needless to say, I was posted to the British military mission to France, and then spent the next 18 months in Algiers with the French Fusiliers Marins. Flew home in the middle of that, got married, and my wife came back with me. Then we came home when that finished. I did a course at Combined Ops School at somewhere in North Devon with people like Blondie Hasler as a fellow student and Charles Rees on the director's staff. And posted to Plymouth, first of all on the staff, and then later on in the officers' school. And I'm now getting up to 1949-1950. And I reckon there was talk of the Marines being disbanded, or at the very least being severely cut down. Before the war, my brother, when I was still at school, my brother, who was in Belair, had been very keen and keen on getting me to join the Malayan Civil Service. And so at this stage, I knew that they were looking for volunteers to join the Malayan Civil Service. Although I didn't have the educational qualifications, normally they wanted a first class degree, when I had no degree of any kind. Nicol Gray, who'd been my CO, was now the, whatever they call them, the Commissioner of Police in Malaya. He had someone back in this country who was trying to recruit for the Malayan police, and he put him in touch with me. And in other words, there was an opening in the Malayan police, and I wanted it. This wasn't really quite what I was after. Cut a long story short, I did apply for the MCS, and at some stage here, the Korean War started.
That was 1915.
Yeah, oh, yes, I'm just trying to think of the month. June, yes. So Douglas Drysdale, who commanded the independent commander, 41 commander, he was at that time the second in command of the officers' school where I was an instructor. And he took with him my great friend Rafe Parkinson Cummins, who was killed in Korea. And Tim Gray was the then commandant of the officers' school. And he said to me, did I want to go to Korea with Douglas? And I said, I didn't want to volunteer. If I was ordered to go, naturally I would go. But I had, at this time, already applied to join the Malayan Civil Service. And so, you know, I didn't want to volunteer. So that was that. The Marine Office had told me, Admiralty, whatever they were, that they were not... All releases had been stopped for the time being until they see what the Korean War went, how it went. But by about, say, October, that was I was told I was free to go if I wanted to. So I continued with my application, went up to the colonial office for a board, had a telegram to say I was accepted from there, told the Marines, and then left on the 28th or 29th, of 28th of February.
1951.
Went to Malaya.